True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Citizen called the office at about 4:30 in the morning, told the dispatch center that there was a body burning alongside the highway. So our patrol units were dispatched, and the fire was still going. And she was laying right here, about 25 feet off the highway. The majority of her body had been burned. The clothing that she was wearing had been burned. The left side of her face was about the only part of her body that did not burn, in addition to her back of her legs, because they were on the ground.
There was absolutely no identification on this body. There were no witnesses that ever came forward.
She had duct tape across her cheeks and mouth and lips, and she had duct tape on her hands. And the investigators felt that they had what we call a body dump.
All my life I've had that in my mind what happened. I couldn't believe that it actually happened.
She was deathly afraid she might be next.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
To most of us, the relationship between mother and child is a sacred one. We love our children. We put their needs above our own. And we'll do anything to protect them and promote their happiness. But mother of six, Teresa Knorr, didn't seem to feel any such love or devotion for her children, least of all her two daughters, Sheila and Susan. A mother of three sons and three daughters, Teresa wounded her daughter Susan with scissors and with a gun. When she wasn't dead after a few weeks, Teresa tried to remove the bullet herself. The attempted surgery left Susan near death. As her condition worsened, Teresa bound Susan's arms and legs, covered her mouth with duct tape, and ordered her own sons to help take the girl to a deserted road where they burned her alive, dousing her with gasoline. Teresa Knorr forced her other daughter, Sheila, into prostitution. After a few weeks, she accused Sheila of becoming pregnant and passing on a venereal disease through the family toilet seat. She beat Sheila, hog-tied her, and locked her in a hot closet with no ventilation. Once Sheila's body began to decompose in the closet, Teresa ordered her sons to dispose of her. It took several years for Teresa to be brought to justice. During her trial, the public learned that she'd been acquitted in the murder of her husband decades earlier. Her remaining youngest daughter, Terry, was the one to finally get the authorities to investigate her mother and believe what she was telling them, that Teresa was a cold-blooded killer who had enlisted the help of her sons in the murders of her own daughters. As we discuss the disturbing crimes of Teresa Knorr, we will dispel the belief that a mother's love is always selfless, always unconditional. Teresa was a dangerous and cruel mother, but the myth of all mothers putting their children first actually worked to silence those who had chances to stop her. Where were the good people in this story who could have saved her children? Teresa didn't strike out of nowhere. She calculated and carried out her abuses over a period of years, leaving a trail of breadcrumbs and clues that were clearly ignored. Teresa's abuse could have been stopped, but nobody moved to stop her. It was a legal system hesitant to believe her capable of murder, along with a society intent on minding its own business, who let her get away with the murder of two of her children and nightmarish abuses of the other four. It's a really tough case this week, Dickie, so I hope you've brought along some hard stuff.
Well, I brought a nice beer, but I'm thinking maybe I should get some more or something. This is a horrible case.
Yeah, we could do some fireball shots in between the beers.
We might have to. Anyway, my beer is Cable Car, brewed by the Lost Abbey in San Marcos, California. This is an American wild ale. So remember, these are beers that are fermented spontaneously, so they're in kind of an open tank, and all sorts of critters can float in there.
All right.
So this is a clear gold colored beer, very thick white head that stayed around for a long time, left a good deal of lace, very pretty. Nice aroma, tart fruit, some oak, great taste, a lot of fruit. I got some green apple, some pear, some grape.
This sounds like my kind of beer.
Some tart cherry. This is yours.
All right.
In fact, I'm going to let you drink most of it. Medium-bodied beer, very lively carbonation, pretty beer, brizzy.
Sprizzy?
And it's got a nice dry tart finish to it. This is one of those great beers.
It sounds great, yeah. So highly recommended, even though you're not giving it a number of stars or thumbs up. It is highly recommended for a sour lover.
A sour lover would put this at the top of a heap of sours.
Yum.
And even non-sour beer drinkers would really like this beer. It's a great beer.
Okay, let's open it up and give it a try.
Okay.
All right, let's sidle on down to the quiet end and begin this tough discussion that we have today.
All right. Teresa Knorr was born Teresa Jimmy Cross in Sacramento, California. She was the youngest child in her family. And when she was 8 years old, her family moved to Rio Linda. This was the kind of town where the American Legion Hall was the center of social life. Many extended families lived their lives from one generation to the next in mobile home parks. Definitely not much going on for kids in Rio Linda. Like her mother, Swanee Gay, and father, Jim Cross, and older sister, Rosemary, young Teresa found that people there liked to keep to themselves and tried not to mind other people's business. Teresa's mom was a friendly person, and from the outside, the Cross home seemed pleasant and tolerable. No one was rude to visitors, but at the same time, the family members were not particularly warm or inviting.
Yeah, and they tried to be polite.
It never seemed like a happy time at Rosemary's house, recalls Heike McGinnis, Rosemary's best friend throughout high school. It was never really fun to go over to visit the way it was with her other friends. You'd get there, Rosemary always seemed to want to leave as soon as possible. She'd grab Heike by the arm and rush her out the door, rather than hang around and make small talk with her parents. Now, one of Swanee Gay's specialties was tarot card readings.
Uh-huh. To predict the future.
That's the best way to do it, don't you think, with tarots?
I don't know the stats on it, but it sounds solid.
Very well studied. Now, for Teresa, she predicted 6 children, 3 boys and 3 girls.
There you go.
See? She also predicted that one of the girls would bring Teresa grief. Mr. Cross was 3 years older than his wife, Swanee Gay. He was colder and stricter than her, but he deferred to her when it came to running the household and taking care of the kids. She was a stay-at-home mom, and she believed in being organized and tidy. And she expected her daughters to do the house cleaning. When the girls came home late from school, Swanee would paddle them as punishment for slacking off with their chores. Now, she had been raised to work from a young age and to pull her own weight. And apparently, she thought her children should be the same way.
Yeah, especially Rosemary. When the girls wanted to play with friends, their friends had to go to the Cross home because Mrs. Cross wouldn't allow Teresa and Rosemary to leave their own yard when they were little. When infrequent visitors did drop by, Mrs. Cross was the hostess while Jim would hide somewhere in the back of the house. To the neighborhood kids, Mr. Cross seemed sinister and mysterious, but it's more likely he was just not a very social guy. Jim Cross was a hard-working man. He drove a milk truck to the dairy where he worked every day, and he never did say much to the neighbors. Even on weekends when he was at home, he wasn't super talkative or participating in neighborhood events. James Cross had actually been a bachelor until he met Swanee Gay in the early 1940s, but this was her second marriage. She had 2 other children from her previous marriage to a Kentucky railroad engineer named Harry Tapp. When Harry lost his eyesight in a boiler explosion on the railroad in the mid-1930s, he and his family became tenant farmers. He refused to accept charity, and they barely scraped by until he died in 1939. Swanee wasn't too proud to take welfare, though. With the little bit of support she got from the state, she moved from the farm closer to the city. And she and her son, William Hart Tapp, and daughter Clara moved into a converted chicken coop in Broderick, northwest of Sacramento. Then she began looking for a new husband. Now, she was getting a little too old to start a new family, but when she met a bachelor who wanted to have a son to carry on his family name, she agreed. By the time she and Jim Cross drove to Reno and got married in 1942, Swanee was 34 years old and he was 37. But he was a pretty good catch. He'd studied at the California Agricultural College at Davis, and he had a steady job. He was an assistant cheesemaker at Sacramento's Golden State Dairy. So for the first few years of their marriage, the Crosses and Swanee's two children moved around from one rented home to another. By 1944, the Crosses had moved into a two-bedroom house on Sacramento's rural southeast side, and Swanee gave birth to Jim's first child, Rosemary Cross. So it wasn't the boy he'd been hoping for.
No, it wasn't.
2 years later, they bought a small house in the Del Paso Heights neighborhood, which was north of downtown Sacramento. And that's where Teresa was born in 1946, so two girls, no son. Clara Tapp became the surrogate mother to these two younger half-sisters, and she cared for them while Swanee went to work. Sometimes she was forced to stay home from school for weeks at a time, and Clara also worked as a waitress and a short order cook from age 14 until she graduated from high school. Jim Cross demanded $60 a month from her for room and board, and that was quite a bit of money to ask from his daughter.
It sure was. And the other thing about this was that her older brother, Bill, didn't pay any rent.
No, there was definitely unequal treatment of the kids.
Yeah. Bill, though, had been in trouble often from the moment Swanee and Jim were first married. But he was a boy, and boys were the preferred sex in the family. Clara told the story of how she was so unimportant that she didn't even have a legal name until she was an adult. She found out when she had to show an employer her birth certificate. She was identified on the certificate as Baby Tapp. Her mother had never bothered to name her legally until the hurt 20-year-old Clara went to her and demanded that she sign the papers to give her a full name on her birth certificate.
Well, Jim Cross was so disappointed that he'd fathered only girls with his wife that he did consider adopting Bill as his own son. As the only son growing up in the Cross household, Bill was constantly forgiven. When he was caught taking things that didn't belong to him, Jim would scold him, and Swanee would make excuses for him. Even after he became a teenager and then graduated to burglarizing neighbors' houses, breaking into cars, and shoplifting from the nearby stores, Swanee defended him.
Bill was a smooth-talking, handsome young man whose personality and good looks covered up his less than stellar character. Let's face it, he was a con artist, even as a kid. Bill interpreted the lack of consequences as a license to remain dishonest and irresponsible. Jim Cross was a devout Catholic who had insisted Swanee convert from a Presbyterian faith when they were married. And when Bill began getting into trouble, Jim tried to get him to make amends by going to confession, which he did, but he always slipped back.
Slipping Billy.
Like Slipping Jimmy, huh?
Yep.
He was also a womanizer, first-class womanizer. The year Teresa was born, Bill turned 18 and came close to being charged with statutory rape after he drove a 15-year-old girlfriend to Reno, lied about her age, and married her just so that he could have sex with her. The girl's parents had the marriage annulled, and Jim Cross was infuriated and embarrassed. So he encouraged Bill to join the Navy and get away from his hometown, because his name was Mud, wasn't Bill.
No.
Mud.
No, he did not have a good reputation. So he returned home early from the Navy, though, after he joined. He was discharged for stealing, no big surprise. So he lived off and on with his parents until he got married, moved away, and had three sons of his own. Rosemary and Teresa didn't see their older brother much when they were growing up. There was such a huge age difference.
Yeah, I guess.
But the Crosses were finally doing pretty well in the early 1950s. They sold their first home and bought a bigger house on a half acre in Rio Linda. Clara married and left home in 1950, but she returned to babysit her two younger sisters when she was needed. Even when the girls were still small, Clara saw a clear difference between Rosemary and Teresa. Rosemary was stocky like her mom, and she was the family worker, kind of like a Cinderella who did all the work and got little appreciation from the family. Teresa, who was tiny and kind of frail-looking, was the favorite daughter. She received the same kind of favoritism that Bill had been given when he was there. So Swanee was doting on Teresa now, and she kind of picked on Rosemary, didn't treat Rosemary nearly as well.
Now, by the late 1950s, the Cross family's good life in Rio Linda had ended. First, Jim Cross became disabled with Parkinson's disease, so he could no longer work. And following an unsuccessful brain surgery for the Parkinson's, he had to retire early from the dairy.
So the more his health deteriorated, the angrier and more frustrated he became. He did not deal well with this. His whole life had really been his job. And I've known men like this before. Once they lose their job, they just are done. They give up. Because that's their identity. So when he lost his job, it seemed like he lost everything. Now, when Rosemary and Teresa were teenagers, they were very pretty. Rosemary was taller and the more developed one. And she walked with a bit of a stoop, trying to hide how tall she was. She didn't want to be taller than the boys. So she didn't date much, and she wasn't boy crazy. But Teresa was definitely boy crazy from her early teens. She often talked about sex, to excess, really. She seemed to be competing constantly with her sister for male attention, too. Now, Rosemary was the older one. She was social and had a lot of girlfriends. But Teresa tended to be more of a loner. She was a very selfish person, probably because her mother was always telling her how special and beautiful she was. So she really basked in her mother's praise, and she bragged to her friends that Rosemary was jealous of her, because their mother actually admitted that she liked Teresa best.
Now, Teresa worshipped her mother. Absolutely worshipped her. But Swanee Gay Cross had a history of heart disease. She was also diabetic and very overweight. Those aren't a real good combination of things to have.
No, and she wasn't getting treated for anything either.
Right. But even so, her death was sudden and unexpected. She had picked Teresa up from school one day. They went shopping, and just as they were walking out of the grocery store, Swanee collapsed. Teresa was standing beside her. She fell so hard against the door jamb at the store entrance that she broke the frame. When she was an adult, Teresa would often repeat the tragic story of how she caught her mother in her arms and watched as she died while she waited for the ambulance to come.
So I guess you could point this out as kind of a turning point in her life, and maybe it had some kind of effect that helped her to turn out as such a disturbed person later on?
Sure.
There's
definitely a traumatic event here, right?
Yeah, Swanee Gay was only 53 when this happened. And she was buried 8 days before Teresa's 15th birthday, so that had to be traumatic. Now, poor Rosemary, she became like the mother after her mom died. And during that time, Teresa wasn't much help. Now, she could have just been your normal, annoying teenager. Rosemary was the strong one, though, so she had to take over. She worked a part-time job while she went to high school. And when she was 17, while still a junior in high school, Rosemary took her mother's place as homemaker and mother to Teresa. She also took a job as a bookkeeper in order to help make ends meet. Because remember, now the dad is disabled.
Right, he's not working, not able to work.
No, and he's in a bad way. He's not very pleasant.
No. Well, you know, he wasn't very pleasant to begin with.
No.
And he's got this debilitating disease that wasn't well treated.
Right.
Back in the 50s.
Exactly.
And he'd had brain surgery that was unsuccessful. So he probably felt like shit.
Yeah, he was a cranker for sure. In the months after her mom's death, Teresa's home life really fell apart. First, Rosemary got married and moved away, and you can't blame her.
No.
And next, the only home she'd ever knew went into foreclosure. So it didn't take long for her to begin looking around for her own man that would take care of her and her disabled dad. So Teresa met an Alabama farmhand who'd followed his older brothers and sister to California in 1959, and his name was Clifford Sanders. He was 5 years older than Teresa, and he turned out to be quite an easy catch for this young, attractive, manipulative Teresa. Teresa quickly had him wrapped around her little finger, and she teased him with the possibility of sex with her. He wanted her, and she had him actually begging. And she had a big ego. You know, she'd been told how beautiful she was from her mother for years. So she really bragged about herself, too, and she enjoyed having power over other people, especially men. So this was just ideal for her. So, of course, Clifford got down on his knees and asked her dad to give his consent for marriage. Jim agreed, and he accompanied them on a weekend trip to Reno. Teresa married Clifford in September of 1962.
So she was, what, like 16 or so?
Yep, because her mom had just died when she was 15.
Yep.
So newly married Teresa did not return to high school for the fall semester of her junior year. She was done.
She was. She's a married woman.
Yeah.
So this gawky Alabama farmer, old Clifford, was pleasant enough when he was sober. But he'd get a few drinks in him and get totally out of control. And he did enjoy his drink. His barroom brawls did not go over well with Teresa. She was very afraid of losing her meal ticket to alcohol to another woman. So their marriage was pretty unstable right from the beginning. Besides this drink, he liked to chase after women. But he was neither rich nor handsome. So the chances of Teresa losing her grip on him to another woman were pretty slim.
Yeah, it's not like the women were after him or anything.
No.
No.
Doesn't have enough of the prerequisites for that.
No, he wasn't super desirable.
Now, Tom Sanders, Cliff's older brother, would say that Cliff wasn't any more of a drinker than any other young man his age. He liked fishing, beer, and a little bar brawl once in a while. Yeah, who doesn't?
I never understood the bar brawl, but okay.
You know, that's what I like. Drink some beer and get in a good fight every once in a while.
Right, sure. Well, Tom disliked Teresa from the start. He tried to talk his brother out of marrying her, but of course Cliff's mind was made up. Once he was married, he tried harder to be a success, because that's what Teresa wanted. So Tom got him a job helping on a water tower near Sacramento State University. Now, Clifford was an unskilled day laborer, but he did pay the rent, and he always provided food and whatever was needed. After they were married, Cliff and Teresa moved into a duplex a few miles from the trailer where her sister and brother-in-law lived. So that's Rosemary and her new husband.
Yeah.
So Rosemary didn't really marry up either. But Rosemary was a smart woman, and she would actually become quite successful on her own. So on July 16th, 1963, almost 10 months after their wedding, Teresa gave birth to Howard Sanders, her first son. The next day in the same hospital, Rosemary had her son, who she named Joseph. Cliff and Teresa had been married over a year before he was eligible to join the Carpenters Union and get medical, pension, and insurance benefits that would go along with his union membership. But he got a job as an apprentice carpenter in Sacramento. So even though he didn't have education or any particular skills, he did work hard and he supported his wife and son okay. And they'd named the baby Howard after his own father and gave him his middle name, Clyde.
And on the outside, the family seemed to be a happy little family. But Clifford was actually having a tough time adjusting to his life with Teresa. She was convinced that he was sleeping around, and she constantly confronted him about this. She told friends and family that her husband bragged to her face about the women he had had sex with during their marriage. The jealousy often led to domestic disputes in which tiny Teresa claimed she was being physically threatened.
In the spring of 1964, while Howard was still breastfeeding, Teresa became pregnant again, and Clifford questioned whether this child was actually his. And that really pissed her off. That was the final straw for her. She'd had enough of the fighting and the accusations. So she's only 18, but Teresa and her little son moved out of the house and into this tiny little shack in the town of Galt, which was about 20 miles south of Sacramento. But after cooling off for a couple of weeks, Clifford followed Teresa to Galt, and they did reconcile. Clifford wanted to be with Howard, his son. He really adored him. But the trouble between Teresa and Clifford was far from over. While Clifford was mild-mannered and sober most of the time, after a few drinks, he could really be taunted easily into erupting and being abusive. And when things got too bad, he would actually strike his wife and walk out. So at the beginning of the marriage, he'd leave for a few hours. But by this time, when they lived in Galt, he would sometimes leave for days after these arguments.
So one day in June in 1964, Clifford came home, started drinking, started arguing with his wife, and then threw her purse at a living room window, which broke the glass. Then he hit her, she later told police. But this time Teresa defended herself. On the advice of Constable May, who lived across the street from them, she went to the police. She showed them the bruises around her wrists and neck, told them she wanted to make a citizen's arrest, and filed assault and battery charges against her husband. But when it came time to arrest Clifford, she refused to press charges. Things don't change too much a lot of times, do they?
No. Of course, nowadays, I don't think that you need to press charges. The police can still take care of it the evidence.
Yeah. Billy did that. And a lot of these domestic violence charges were swept away because of refusal to testify.
Sure. Well, even in the 90s with Nicole Brown Simpson, the same thing happened repeatedly.
Yeah.
So Clifford was released before any paperwork was even filed about this.
Right.
So 2 weeks passed by, and Clifford stayed home on the 4th of July weekend. On Sunday, July 5th, he celebrated his 23rd birthday, but it was definitely not a happy one. Things had continued to deteriorate between him and Teresa, and Teresa accused him of cheating on her again. Clifford again questioned whether the baby she was carrying was his. The next morning, Monday, he packed his bags, but he never got past the front door. Clifford had abused Teresa before, and he told her he was going to beat her again, according to Teresa. He told her that he was going to take whatever money they had and leave her. He had already packed a suitcase, and there was a cardboard box full of his things. When she went into the bedroom, got their Winchester deer rifle, and returned to the living room. And as Clifford was about to leave, she aimed the gun and held her finger on the trigger, pointing it at him. Now, she later told police that she grabbed the gun just to keep him from hitting her, and it went off, and that's all she could remember. A single bullet entered Clifford's heart and killed him. The coroner said that Clifford had apparently held up his left hand to block the bullet because it shattered his wrist before it entered his chest. He had taken several steps toward the back door when he tripped and fell, and he landed flat on his back, staring up at the ceiling and dead. So Teresa at that point had propped the rifle up against the door frame, grabbed her purse and baby Howard, and ran outside to the car. But she only drove about 100 feet down the block before she stopped in front of her neighbor's house. This was at 9:20 in the morning, and their 11-year-old son answered the door and saw this hysterical neighbor, Mrs. Sanders. She was sobbing over and over that she had shot Clifford in the arm and he needed help. So this boy went and woke up his parents. I don't know why they're in bed at 9:20. It seems a little late to me, but they were in bed.
Well, it was a holiday weekend.
Sure.
Maybe they were celebrating.
But this was Monday.
Well.
Anyway, that's really not the point of the story, I guess. But she was sobbing over and over, and he woke his parents, and the dad went across the street to help Clifford, while the mom tried to sit and settle down Teresa. So these neighbors remembered Teresa coming to the house 2 weeks earlier and complaining about Clifford's abuse. They remembered Teresa telling them that Clifford had slapped her around and then left her to take care of the baby and her invalid father all by herself. They saw the bruises that she had gotten from Clifford, and they recommended that Teresa go to the police and file assault charges, but Teresa dropped the charges because she thought that he had learned his lesson. So still, Clifford had not stopped abusing her. He was trying to hurt her again when she went to get the rifle, she said. And she was just sitting there rocking back and forth with baby Howard, seemingly unaware that he was dead. So we're not sure.
Seemingly.
Yeah.
So we get to the house, and there's a trail of type A blood running through the house from the front porch to the back, where Clifford's dead foot held open the screen door. Inside, the house was clean and tidy in the front room, except for a shattered ceramic horse on top of the TV that had apparently been hit by the same bullet that killed Clifford. The bedroom and kitchen were a mess. Bed was unmade with piles of laundry, income tax forms and other papers piled on one end of the mattress. In the kitchen, dirty dishes, empty drink bottles, watermelon rinds, just a mess, were scattered on the dining table. Clifford was dressed in khaki trousers, black shoes, and a white t-shirt. He had $1.70 in his pocket and 2 money orders in his wallet for about $60. Teresa apparently didn't know that Clifford was dead when an ambulance pulled up outside her house. When she was told that he had died, she let out this blood-curdling scream.
So she was arrested and sent to the Sacramento jail. Her attorney asks permission for her to attend her late husband's funeral 3 days later, and the sheriff's department escorted her to and from the cemetery. According to Clifford's brother Tom, Teresa paid for the funeral out of the life insurance money she collected from the Carpenters Union policy that Clifford had on himself. So the case attracted the press. She was petite, pretty, and pregnant, made her a very sympathetic defendant. Even if she had been the most sympathetic client in the world, she had shot her husband to death, though. That's hard to get around.
It certainly is.
Although she claimed self-defense, this was before anyone had really heard of battered spouse syndrome, so that really wasn't something that they could use. Any hope Teresa had that she might be set free on this claim of self-defense went away when the Sacramento County Grand Jury heard testimony to charge her with murder.
Yep, so we're going to go to trial.
Yep.
Okay.
So they're going to take her to trial for murder.
Well, why don't we stop here real quick so you can talk about your favorite Madison. That's Madison Reed.
Uh-huh.
Let's hear it.
Our favorite beauty product sponsor?
That's the one.
Okay, well, let's share this beauty secret for people who want salon quality hair color at home. And of course, that's Madison Reed. Now, like I've said before, I really love Madison Reed because it's a company founded by a woman and a mother, Amy Arrett, and she named the company after her daughter. Plus, it's just a great product. The way that she managed to combine the salon quality we love with the affordability that we need to give us beautiful, multidimensional hair color at home really has revolutionized the way that women are coloring their hair. She's bringing us into the future, and we're looking damn good. The uncertainty and so-so quality of store-bought coloring kits has motivated me to go to a professional in the past and spend quite a bit of money on my hair. But Madison Reed has brought me back home because it has really super high-quality hair color. When you use Madison Reed, you will look like you just walked out of a salon. It's convenient at-home hair color. It has an ammonia-free salon-quality formula, too. Madison Reed is made in Italy, but it's delivered to your door for under $25. And I really love how their website has hair models of all ages and sizes and colors. It's a product that's developed by a real woman, and it's marketed to all of us real women, and I just really enjoy that. You can find your perfect shade at madison-reed.com, and Madison Reed honors our True Crime Brewery listeners with 10% off plus free shipping on your first color kit. Just use promo code BREWERY. That website is madison-reed.com, and our code is BREWERY.
Okay, back to the story. On August 4th, 1964, Teresa entered a plea of not guilty by reason of self-defense in a Sacramento courtroom. Her trial was scheduled to begin 3 weeks later. Now, the district attorney wanted a first-degree murder conviction, and he accused Teresa of murdering her husband in cold blood and insisted she had made up the allegations of self-defense in order to spare herself a prison sentence. Mm-hmm. The murder, in his view, was committed because of Teresa's suspicions that her husband was cheating on her. Teresa's attorney argued that Teresa acted out of self-defense and was only protecting herself and her unborn child.
Yeah, I think that pregnancy made her very sympathetic.
That's a big help, isn't it?
Sure, yeah. Well, one of the first witnesses that was called to the stand was a Dr. Arthur Wallace, and this was the man who performed Clifford's autopsy. He testified that there were no powder burns on his body, and blood tests showed no alcohol. Remember, this was 9 o'clock in the morning. He described the injuries to Clifford's body and testified that the bullet had passed through his wrist before landing in his heart. Now, surprisingly, Teresa took the stand and testified, and she told the jury a very sad story of physical abuse, and she said that her husband was a very violent alcoholic. A mental health counselor described Teresa as anxious, remorseful, and very frightened. It was his opinion that she acted in self-defense and was not capable of committing a cold-blooded murder. Now, friends and relatives testified and described Teresa as a sweet young girl who didn't know what she was getting into when she married Clifford Sanders. Like, he was trouble. So after deliberating for about an hour and 45 minutes only, the jury found her not guilty. While Teresa was in jail, her sister Rosemary had been taking care of her infant son, Howard. Now, Rosemary, as you remember, was living in a trailer park, and her husband was unemployed, so life is not easy for her. So her and her husband weren't in a great position to take care of another baby. So as it turned out, Rosemary gave little baby Howard to an old friend of her mother's, an older woman named Bea Howard. According to Bea, Teresa's first child looked like a Holocaust survivor. She said he was hollow-eyed and very thin. But Bea and her husband thought he was just the sweetest. They weren't very prepared for him because they were middle-aged, their kids had already grown up, and they'd already given away any baby clothes that they had left over. Now, when Rosemary dropped him off, he had only 3 diapers. They went out and they spent about $100 on clothing and supplies. That's a lot of money back then.
Certainly was. So the baby seemed to be comfortable, and he hardly cried at all when Rosemary left him there. He bonded with Mr. Howard and clung on happily when he was carried around the yard on his shoulders.
Now, but if they had adopted him, his name would be Howard Howard. So that wouldn't be okay.
Oh, we'd have to do something.
Although it could be like Philip Phillips, Howie Howard, it might not be that bad.
It'd be bad.
But they bonded.
It seemed to be a happy home for the little boy.
It did.
So after her acquittal, Teresa came home to Rio Linda and her baby. She's a free woman, but she was 4 months pregnant, homeless, unemployed, and broke. And her son had already started to forget her, according to Mrs. Howard. The Howards remember baby Howard clinging to them and shying away from his mother. So Bea generously offered to let Teresa stay with them until she got reacquainted with her baby and was back on her feet financially. She put strict conditions on her, including no dating, helping around the house, caring for her baby, and going back to school.
Well, yeah, remember, she's only 18, and she has a child, and she's pregnant. So Bea was trying to help her. And Teresa agreed to all this, but she began breaking the rules within a week or two. She started having an affair with an art instructor at a local college who was paying her $5 an hour to pose nude for him. And she began hanging out at the American Legion Hall and having her old friends over to the house to visit. Now, I think at the American Legion Hall, you're pretty much just drinking and dancing.
Yeah, you're just relaxing.
Well, she's 18, though, so I don't know if this is the best way to spend her time when she's supposed to be going to school and, you know, learning how to take care of her kids on her own eventually.
Right. Well, that's not happening.
No. So, of course, this irritated Bea Howard, who's trying to help out.
Right. One of her friends at the American Legion Hall brought along a young Army veteran who was confined to a wheelchair. His name was Lee Thornsberry. Lee was an ex-soldier who had been stationed in Germany before a diving accident injured his 4th and 5th vertebrae. So that's high up in the neck, cervical vertebrae. So he was a quadriplegic.
He was.
It wasn't so high that he couldn't breathe on his own, so he wasn't on a ventilator or anything like that, but he couldn't move.
No, nothing below his shoulders and confined to a wheelchair with no possibility that he would ever get any movement back.
And the government provided Lee with a generous monthly check. Now, he couldn't spend his money on sports or fishing trips anymore, but he bought himself a car he really liked. This is a sporty Pontiac that was made specially for him so that he could drive it with his very limited upper body movement. I would think it'd be very limited. I mean, if he's injured at his 4th and 5th vertebrae, he doesn't have much in his arms.
No, maybe his upper body movement was like the straw in the mouth thing. No, upper body couldn't be your head?
No. Well, it is. But back in the 60s, they didn't have ways of steering a car with a straw in your mouth.
So he must have had a little bit of movement. Now, Teresa didn't fall in love with him, but she did fall instantly in love with this nice sporty car that he had. And he let her drive it around town, and then he started giving her money and gifts, too. Because he probably doesn't get a lot of female attention.
Probably doesn't.
No.
Now, after a few weeks, Bea Howard asked Teresa to leave. That's a big surprise. Lee moved in with Teresa and helped her through her last few months of pregnancy. When her water broke, Lee and his mother drove her to the hospital to deliver her second child. On March 13, 1965, Sheila Sanders was born. Teresa gave her the middle name of Gay after her mother. But instead of going home with Lee following Sheila's birth, Teresa returned to Bea and Craig Howard's place to recuperate. Craig was very happy to be able to put little Howard up on his shoulders again. but a week of Teresa was all he could put up with. Teresa took advantage and demanded that the couple wait on her, as well as feed, bathe, clothe, and entertain little Howard and her new baby. Lee called to tell Teresa that he had rented them a house. He was totally in love with her.
Well, sure he was. I mean, the poor guy. How many opportunities does he have at this point? And she is leading him on, it seems like.
Sure.
And using him totally. So her and her two children moved in with Lee, and they went out and started buying furniture and appliances, planning to get married. So for the first time since her murder trial, Teresa told Lee what had happened between her and Clifford. And she talked about how Clifford had abused her and beat her repeatedly. But she wasn't sad, she seemed to be bragging, and she threatened that she'd shot one man, and she wasn't afraid to do it again if necessary. It seemed kind of like an empowering event for her. She didn't break down in tears over it. Now, Lee believed the story of abuse, but then he was believing everything she told him at this point. He just wanted to believe her because he was in love with her and was hoping she would stay with him.
And Teresa's attitude toward her children changed. On the one hand, she is becoming a better mother. But in the most essential way, she is worse, very cold and hard. So her kids always had clean clothes, their diapers were always changed, they were always well fed. But Teresa obviously favored Howard and neglected Sheila, even when she was a tiny infant. This is bringing back memories of her own childhood.
Right, exactly.
With her mother favoring her over her sister, Rosemary.
Yep.
She told Lee that she was going to favor Howard and neglect Sheila just the same way her mother had done with her and her sister.
So she's purposely chosen to do this, which I don't understand. But it did seem like it was a choice. So now there's Bob Knorr. He had become one of Teresa's men on the side at this time.
And how did he do that?
Because she was going out and seeing other guys.
Okay. So, yeah, well, she hadn't married Lee, right?
No, they didn't get married. She was just using him.
Yeah. So she was still looking around.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And he got another explanation about why she was cuddling Howard and ignoring Sheila. Teresa told Bob that she hated Sheila because she was pregnant with her when she killed Clifford. And Teresa actually blamed her unborn child for the events that led to her shooting of Clifford.
It's a unique one.
As we remember, Clifford had accused her of sleeping around and said that Sheila wasn't his baby, and that had started the argument that ended in Clifford's death. And for some unimaginable reason, she blamed Sheila for this. So that's a pathology right there.
Yes. Quite a bit.
Yeah.
The arguments between Lee and Teresa began soon, just as they had done between Clifford and Teresa. But Lee was not dissuaded. After
he doesn't have a lot of choices.
Well, he doesn't, does he?
No.
After an argument, he'd just buy a bottle of alcohol and drink himself unconscious, while Teresa took off with his money for a night on the town. So Teresa is living with Lee, sleeping with Bob. She'd get dressed up, put the kids in the car, travel around to bars, sometimes leaving the kids locked up in the back seat for hours. Lee lived with the humiliation for almost a year. Then he finally broke up with Teresa.
Well, good for him.
No kidding. He moved out of the house near the end of 1965. But Teresa stayed until she was forced to move. When Lee returned to pick up his few remaining things, he found nothing in the house.
No, she'd sold off, like the washer-dryer they'd bought. She'd taken the furniture. Just really, no conscience at all as far as taking his stuff. Now she'd found a new place to live, and she'd found a new father figure for her kids, and that was Bob Knorr. He was 6 foot tall, blonde, blue-eyed, good-looking guy, 2 years younger than her. But he had no experience with girls. He followed her around like a puppy. And she loved the way he looked in his dress uniform. Super handsome. Bob had joined the Marine Corps a year before he and Teresa had met, and he was a virgin and super naive about women. Teresa had sex with Bob, and they visited the bars in the Sacramento suburb of Citrus Heights almost every night. Almost every night, Bob Knorr got lucky. He knew nothing about Teresa except what she wanted him to know. He didn't even know that she had two children, or that she'd been acquitted of murdering her husband, or that she was living with and engaged to a quadriplegic when they started having sex together. Bob went to Vietnam, where he was injured in 3 separate events, and when he returned, Teresa was at his bedside, fussing over him. By that time, she was pregnant with his child. Her pregnancy was beginning to show, and she wanted to get married right away. And of course, so did Bob, because he was smitten.
He's gone.
Yep.
So when Teresa was 7 months pregnant, in July 1996, she and Bob drove to Nevada and got married in front of a judge. Bob's first marriage and Teresa's second. Both seemed happy. They rented a small apartment in Sacramento. 2 months later, Teresa gave birth to her third child, a girl. They named her Susan Marlene Knorr. Less than 3 months later, Teresa was pregnant again, and in September of 1967, she gave Robert his first son, William Robert Knorr. A second son, Teresa's fifth child, was born in December 1968.
So she's pretty much just pregnant through the whole 60s.
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much. But Bob continued his career in the military, and he eventually began to work as a burial escort. This job often required him to leave his family and travel around the country, which he kind of enjoyed because the marriage was tumultuous and they were fighting often. But Teresa did not like Bob's new job, and she regularly complained that he was cheating on her when he was out on the road. So just as she'd been with Clifford, she began accusing him of infidelity all the time. Teresa often took her anger out on the kids, especially the 2 girls, because remember, she's favoring the boys. She would punish them by forcing them to sit on the floor without moving, and if they moved an inch or even looked at her, she would become enraged and go over and slap them. And if that didn't work, she was known to lock them in a closet or to force feed them until they vomited. So we can see the dysfunction is getting worse.
Sure is.
Yeah. And I mean, now it's out-and-out abuse.
And this is abuse. And,
yes.
And just sadistic abuse.
That's a good word for it, Dick. Thanks. I was trying to describe it, but sadistic does it.
So by June of 1969, Robert and Teresa were constantly at odds. He left the kids behind, packed up his basic belongings, and moved out. Teresa retaliated by filing for divorce on grounds of extreme cruelty. But a few weeks later, they reconciled, and Teresa dismissed her charges. Now, as much as Robert did want to make the marriage work, it was way too late. A year later, Teresa again filed for divorce. She was pregnant with her 6th child, which would be Robert's 4th. The same judge that presided over Teresa's murder granted the divorce in June 1970. 2 months later, Teresa gave birth and named the girl after herself, Teresa Marie Knorr. Following the divorce, Robert tried to visit his children, but Teresa did not want anything to do with him and repeatedly denied him the right to see the kids.
Yeah, and this went on and on for years. Despite the divorce, Teresa still saw Bob as her property, and she wasn't ready to give him to another woman. She actually began stalking him and his new girlfriend. Now, the new serious girlfriend he got was named Georgia, this very attractive Hispanic woman who was the same age as Teresa. They would see her in their rearview mirror, driving up behind them, and then they'd make turns and she would make the same turns. If they'd make a U-turn, she'd make a U-turn, so they know she's following them. They actually started driving on the back roads just to try and avoid her. The harassment didn't stop there because Teresa made a scene whenever she saw them out in public together. She called Georgia's parents' house, and she called Georgia awful names, of course, like whore, slut, and dirty Mexican. So she had no boundaries, no decency there.
No, she didn't. Now, despite Teresa's continued harassment, Bob married Georgia 4 months after Terry was born. When she wasn't out at bars, Teresa and her next-door neighbor often sat up until all hours, drinking and talking about their favorite mutual interest, the occult. As often as possible, Teresa persuaded her neighbor to watch her kids while she went out looking for a new husband. For a short time, she got a job tending bar at a topless lounge. She moved from there to other bars, bartending or waiting tables. It was at a blue-collar bar on Sacramento's industrial west side that Teresa met Ron Pulliam, a 28-year-old railroad worker. 3 months after Bob married Georgia, Teresa married Ron Pulliam. Just 2 weeks after Teresa's 25th birthday, they drove to Reno and exchanged vows at a 24-hour-a-day wedding chapel.
So this woman's been through a lot in 25 years. She has 6 kids and 3 marriages.
And she's on her 3rd husband.
Yeah.
And she's killed 1 husband.
Right. And it's kind of a hard scrabble life, so I can have a little empathy in the beginning with her. But that doesn't last long. Well, history soon repeated itself because Teresa began treating Ron as a possession rather than a partner. And just as she did with Lee, she began leaving her children at home with him while she went out and partied. Eventually, she stopped coming home at all at night. Now, Ron was convinced that she was seeing another man, and he wasn't so dumb. He filed for divorce, so that didn't last long.
No, he got out of there pretty quickly, didn't he?
Yeah. Now, with her newfound freedom, Teresa spent a lot of time drinking at the good old American Legion Hall in Rio Linda. And that's where she met 59-year-old Chet Harris. This guy was a copy desk editor at the Sacramento Union newspaper. And they quickly moved into a relationship, and Teresa married him in August of 1976, just 3 days after they met. So Chet was a very unattractive man, very obese, dirty, smelly. It's just very strange that she married him. But she knew right away it was a mistake because he also was kind of a perverted guy. Shortly after moving in with him, Teresa found out that one of his hobbies was taking photos of nude women. And his bedroom walls were covered with them. Some of them were his ex-wives because I think this guy was married 6 or 7 times. And Teresa really hated him. It didn't take long. But her daughter, Susan, grew kind of close to him, and they would spend hours together working on jigsaw puzzles. Now, Susan, they would say, was the smart kid. She was very intelligent, and she liked to talk to him about history, do puzzles together. She liked his brain because he was a smart guy, even though he was a mess. So the relationship between Susan and Chet Harris was very annoying to Teresa. And 2 months after the marriage began, she filed for divorce from him and told her daughter that she was not allowed to speak to him anymore.
Following her latest divorce, Teresa's children noticed a big change in her behavior. She started to drink even more and began putting on a lot of weight. Her attitude became worse than ever, and the abuse toward the kids became very severe. The more she drank, the crueler she was to her children. One time, she even threw steak knives at him. Another time, during one of her binges, she grabbed Terry by the arm and held a .22 caliber pistol to her head. So for months after, Terry had terrifying nightmares. She started beating the kids on a regular basis, forcing them to take turns holding each other down for her.
Yeah, and Howard, as you remember, is the oldest, and I think it started with her having him hold the kids down as they got too big for her to hold down on her own. And he became a really messed up individual. He actually started molesting some of the younger kids. So that was just, this household was such a disaster. Then Teresa eventually got the idea in her head that Chet Harris had turned her daughter Susan into a witch. So it's not known where this idea came from, but Susan kind of took advantage of it and would use it against her mother, which probably wasn't smart. She would regularly say that Chet Harris was going to initiate her into his cult by deflowering her in the name of Satan. And these stories did spare Susan some abuse for a while. But then she began suffering the worst of Teresa's abuse. Eventually, Susan ran away from home. It was so bad. But her freedom was cut short when she was eventually picked up by a truancy officer, and she was placed into a psychiatric hospital. During her stay at the hospital, Susan told counselors about her family life and about the regular beatings. Now, when confronted about her daughter's allegations, Teresa claimed that her daughter was lying and that her daughter just suffered from mental problems. So it's stunning to me that no one questioned this, and Susan was turned back over to her mom and had to go back home.
Yeah. They didn't even listen to the kid.
No, and as we know, Susan is going to be one of her victims. Well, she already is one of her victims, but one of her murder victims, I mean.
And once they got back home, Susan received one of the most severe beatings of her life. Teresa put on a pair of leather gloves and struck Susan repeatedly, and she forced the other children to join in. They had to pass gloves from one to the other and hit Susan in the stomach. Teresa also didn't want Susan running away again, so at night she'd handcuff her to the bed and force the other children to take turns keeping watch over her. Teresa didn't allow her to go to school. Eventually, Teresa's torment broke Susan's will, and she got to be allowed to sleep alone and unshackled. The fear of another serious beating kept her from trying to escape. Now then, in 1982, Teresa decided that Susan was putting spells on her, and these spells were making her gain weight.
So she's really just crazier than shit now.
She's nuts.
Yeah.
So Susan's protests only made things worse, and Teresa flew into a violent rage. She shot her own daughter with the same .22 caliber pistol she had used to threaten Terry. So she ordered the other children to carry the bleeding Susan to the bathroom and put her in the tub. She didn't want the police involved and forbade the kids from calling an ambulance. The bullet had not passed all the way through Susan's body, but it was too deep to remove from the open wound. So Teresa decided to leave it in and patch her up with gauze and bandages. And for the next month, Susan's sisters looked after her. Terry and Sheila took turns feeding and bathing her, and eventually Susan recovered.
So apparently the school doesn't check up at all on what's going on.
Apparently not, because she's not there at school, is she?
No. So it was in July of 1984 that Teresa got into another argument with Susan and stabbed her in the back with a pair of scissors. Now, this injury wasn't life-threatening, but it was quite serious, and Susan was just tired of this daily abuse. So a few weeks later, she asked for permission to move out of the house, and surprisingly, Teresa agreed with that. But she had this one stipulation. Teresa wanted to remove the bullet that was still lodged in Susan's back because she was afraid that Susan would go to the hospital or the police and get her into trouble. Now, of course, Susan didn't want that, but she was desperate to get out, and she finally agreed that she'd let her mom do home surgery on her to get that bullet out.
She must have been pretty desperate.
It's so sad. Really sad.
So Teresa started the operation by giving Susan a handful of Melaril capsules and a quart of liquor.
Now, is Melaril, it's some kind of psychoactive medication.
Melaril is one of those early antipsychotic drugs.
But it's one that people take at bedtime, I remember from my nursing days.
Yeah.
So it does make you tired.
Yeah, most of them will. Plus with the liquor, that would work too. So Susan got unconscious after the Melaril and liquor. Teresa took an X-Acto knife from the medicine cabinet and ordered 15-year-old Robert to cut into his sister's back and retrieve the bullet. So while he made the incision, Teresa's giving orders to him. He cut through several layers of skin and muscle. Using his fingers, Robert searched around inside the wound until he finally located and removed the bullet. The next day, Susan woke up in horrible pain. Teresa gave her antibiotics and ibuprofen, but the medicines didn't seem to have any effect, and she kept getting worse. After a few days, her eyes turned yellow, and she could no longer control her bowels. So she's probably septic. She's probably got some kind of overwhelming infection. At one point, the youngest child, Terry, noticed black marks on Susan's back, which she concluded were from internal bleeding, a result of Teresa's last beating.
Huh. But it does seem like she was septic, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And instead of calling the 911 or taking her to the doctor, she's just all about protecting herself and letting her daughter die, basically.
Yeah.
In a horrible way.
Very horrible. So on July 16, 1984, Teresa duct taped Susan's mouth shut, bound her arms and legs. After which, she packed all her belongings into trash bags and ordered Bill and Robert to put Susan in the car. They drove south on Highway 89 and eventually pulled off the road by Square Creek Bridge. Bill and Robert were then ordered to take Susan out of the car, carry her down to the creek bank. Teresa brought down the garbage bags herself and then doused everything, including Susan, in gasoline and struck a match.
I really can't think of anything much crueler and sadistic and disgusting than this.
No, this
is awful.
Young girl was still alive.
And her sons, she's pulling them into it.
Yeah.
So she's ruining their lives as well.
So they walked back to the car, and that was it. Things around the Knorr house remained quiet and sullen during the weeks following Susan's death. But eventually everything seemed back to normal, except for the fact that Susan was gone.
Crazy.
Yes.
During the late spring of 1985, so about a year later, Teresa decided to supplement her income by having her 20-year-old daughter Sheila work the streets as a prostitute. Of course, Sheila was horrified by her mother's plan, but she also was not one to disobey her. She'd grown up being abused by this woman. So before long, Sheila's bringing home hundreds of dollars a day from prostitution. And Teresa was actually kind of proud of her, encouraging it.
That says a lot, doesn't it?
It does. Now, she was easing up on her daily beatings, and Sheila was allowed to come and go as she pleased, so she got certain allowances for doing that. Becoming a prostitute seemed to actually improve her relationship with her mother for a while.
It's very short, twisted.
Mm-hmm. Then in May 1985, Sheila's freedom was brought to an end. Teresa suspected that her daughter was pregnant, and then she started accusing her of having a venereal disease, which she claimed that she had gotten off the same toilet. So Teresa's saying that she got a venereal disease off the toilet that Sheila had left there when she used the toilet. Now, we all know that's not how venereal diseases work.
No, you can't get it from the toilet seat, right?
Right. So Sheila was beaten black and blue by her mom. Then she was hogtied and locked in a tiny closet next to the bathroom. It was dangerously hot in this closet, but Teresa had strict orders for the other kids. The door was to be kept closed at all times, and they were not permitted to give their sister any food or water. So there's no way she's going to survive this.
No, there isn't. She did eventually confess in order to appease her mother, but Teresa accused her of lying and the punishment continued. On June 21st, 1985, the third day of Sheila's incarceration, the family heard a loud thump coming from the closet, and this was the last sound they would hear from Sheila. 3 days later, when they opened the door, they discovered Sheila's decomposing body curled up in a fetal position. She had apparently tried to climb up some small shelves in the closet, but they would not hold her weight, and she came crashing down.
This is an awful way to go for anybody.
I can't even comprehend that.
No. I can't imagine doing that to anyone, and your own child, it's unbelievable. And I just can't imagine what's going on in these developing brains of the siblings as well.
No kidding.
It almost seems like Teresa was jealous when her daughters became young women and were more attractive than her. I think that really kind of boosted her rage.
Well, it didn't help, did it?
No.
Here she is, a fat alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
So she's probably going to be jealous of her girls.
I don't know. I think I could be a fat alcoholic and still not be jealous of daughters. Because they're your daughters. You want them to be happy and attractive.
Yeah.
If you're a normal parent.
That's the if. So Teresa grabbed an old cardboard box, filled it up with blankets and pillows. She ordered her two sons to place Sheila's remains inside the box and carry it out to the car.
Unimaginable.
Gets worse. So everyone did as they were told, and eventually they were driving up Interstate 80 towards the airport. Along the way, Teresa spotted a small field and decided to pull off the road. She ordered the boys to unload their sister's cardboard casket and toss it on the side of the road.
So this wouldn't take long to be found. Because it's not really hidden.
It's not hidden, and it's on a fairly busy highway.
Yeah. Yeah, a few hours after it was dropped off, there was this guy, Elmer Barber, who was making his rounds at the Martis Creek campground, and he found this cardboard casket, as you call it. He lifted the flaps of the box open, and what he saw inside would haunt this guy for the rest of his life, of course. Now, he called the Nevada County Sheriff's Department, and within hours, investigators were on the scene. They were unable to make a positive identification, and they didn't really have many clues to work with. The victim was named Jane Doe, number 660785, and her cause of death was listed as undetermined. Now, when I read about this, I thought, I just don't think they were making a lot of effort. I mean, really, there must have been her belongings, her blankets and pillows. I know this is before DNA, but there are clues there if you want to look into it.
There are.
And she hadn't been decomposing for that long.
You'd think they could maybe look for dental records or something.
Something. Although, maybe this girl never went to the dentist.
True. And the other thing is that they were probably going to be passive about it and wait for someone to report a child missing, which wasn't going to happen.
Right. Well, this is a young woman, though. It's not a child. She's 20.
Yeah, that's true. But still, no one's reporting anyone missing.
No. Well, Teresa became extremely paranoid after Sheila's death. And she became concerned that that closet contained evidence, which of course it did. And she knew that it might someday implicate her in her daughter's death. So in September 1986, Teresa packed up all of the family's belongings, and she ordered her remaining daughter, Terry, to set the house on fire. Using charcoal lighter fluid, Terry doused the floors and struck a match before she climbed out of a window. Of course, neighbors were nearby, and they immediately noticed the fire, and the local fire department was dispatched to the scene. So there was very little actual damage done to the home, and investigators were sure that it had been set on purpose, but they didn't have any idea that someone had died there. And Teresa went into hiding. The kids were almost all grown. Howard was 26, and he wanted nothing more to do with his family. His brother William was 24, and he had moved in with a girlfriend. And Terry, the youngest, also left her mom. She was only 16, but she used Sheila's ID and was able to pass herself off as 21. So Teresa's only remaining child at home was 19-year-old Robert, and he was the only one who would stay by her side. He actually moved with her to Las Vegas.
And Teresa's becoming increasingly paranoid.
Yeah.
And she's worried that at any second the police were going to bust in and arrest her, according to Robert. Paranoia didn't come from feeling guilty about anything she had done. In Teresa's point of view, she'd been a good mother who had done the best she could with impossible children. Her fear was that her ungrateful children would turn on her, turn her into the authorities, and make up stories about how evil she was.
It's very demented.
After Terry had moved out, Robert and his mother moved from hotel to hotel for the next few weeks, and they finally did find an apartment. Robert met a girl on the job, dated her, and even went home to meet her parents. Then his mother found out. She disapproved, put a stop to his dating. He wasn't allowed to go out anymore, so he had to come home directly from work. Teresa would call his work to be sure he was there, and she'd wait up at night for him to come home.
Well, this is a relationship based primarily on guilt and paranoia. Teresa claimed she was suffering from a debilitating chronic disease that Susan and Sheila had given her, and that she was going to die from this. Apart from her son Robert's income from bussing tables and washing dishes, she had no money except she had Sheila's monthly checks from Social Security, which she got because her father had died. That's the father that she had killed. And Teresa was still the payee on this. At 16, Robert had become his mother's sole caretaker then, but Teresa hadn't given up on the idea of luring her other children back to be with her, and she did try and do that. One time, Terry, the youngest, contacted her dad, Bob Knorr, when she was 16, and by this time, Bob had divorced Georgia, his second wife, and he was married a third time to a woman with children of her own, including a daughter who was about Terry's age. They lived in Citrus Heights, east of Sacramento. They didn't have a lot of room, but Bob invited Terry to stay with them. He picked his daughter up and tried to reestablish a bond, which they never really had because, remember, he'd left. So he never really had any time with her because Teresa wasn't allowing that after they broke up. So he's trying to rebond with her, but there was trouble immediately. I mean, Terry's a messed up girl from the way she was raised. She's not your normal 16-year-old.
Far from it.
She was very promiscuous and she lied a lot. So this homecoming that Bob had imagined for his and Teresa's youngest daughter did not go at all how he hoped. She was evasive with him when he asked about his other children, too. The only thing Terry told him that she knew for sure was that Robert was living with Teresa and that Howard was probably in jail. When Bob asked about Susan, Terry told him that she had run off to Alaska and no one had heard from her in years. She gave the same story for Sheila. She actually said that Sheila had eloped with an Indian somewhere to the north, and maybe Canada. It wasn't until Terry was gone that Bob learned that Terry had tried to get his stepdaughter to go to a liquor store and buy some liquor with a false ID. And the ID that she used was a driver's license with the name Susan Marlene Knorr. So that would be her murdered sister's ID.
In November 1991, Teresa's son Robert was desperate for money. He walked into a bar, pulled out a gun. The details are kind of sketchy, but in the end, the bartender, Robert Ward, was lying dead at the foot of the bar. Investigators arrested Robert for the murder, and he was later sentenced to 16 years in jail. Teresa was nervous about all the attention, so just a few weeks later, she moved to Salt Lake City, Utah.
So Terry, the youngest, over the years, she tried to tell several people about the murders of her sisters. She drank a lot, and she had mental health issues, so nobody would believe her. And that was until 1992. In 1992, she was watching an episode of America's Most Wanted. None of these cases related to her or her family, but the show inspired her to do the right thing. She contacted the Nevada County Police in California. Terry told them that years earlier, her mother and two brothers had killed her sister by dousing her with gasoline and setting her on fire. The next year, she told them they killed her other sister and dumped her body in the mountains. Sergeant Perea was unsure about her unbelievable story, but she did seem sincere, so he decided to interview her in person. The following day, he met with Terry and interviewed her for several hours. He took his notes to the DA's office, and a task force was put together to investigate this story. Investigators found Sheila and Susan's Jane Doe reports, and that's when they began to put the whole thing together. It was in November 1993 when investigators filed felony complaints against Teresa and her two sons. William was found in a Sacramento suburb where he worked at a warehouse. Investigators soon learned about Robert's previous arrest, and they found him in a Nevada County jail. Neither of the boys was interested in talking with investigators, but both eventually confessed to their involvement in both of their sisters' deaths. California investigators received a call from Salt Lake City authorities telling them that Teresa had been traced by a driver's license application. She had also been arrested just 5 days earlier for drunk driving. Sergeant John Fitzgerald flew to Salt Lake and headed for the address on her license application. So it was just before dusk when he knocked on her door, and Teresa answered right away, and she was arrested. She'd been living with and caring for an 85-year-old woman. She was a nursing assistant. She actually knew about the investigation, and she was in the process of packing to move away. Back at the police station, she refused to cooperate, and she requested a lawyer right away.
So Teresa was charged in the torture killings of her two daughters and was arraigned in a Salt Lake City courtroom on November 15, 1993. According to articles in the Sacramento Bee, she is extradited to Placer County the following month, arraigned there, and charged with 2 counts of murder, 2 counts of conspiracy to commit murder, and 2 special circumstances, multiple murder and murder by torture, charges which could result in a death sentence. Teresa pleaded not guilty and was held in the Sacramento County Jail. William Robert Knorr was prosecuted as an adult. Robert struck a deal with prosecutors and agreed to testify against Teresa in exchange for a lighter sentence. 1 month later, all charges against him, except a single count of conspiracy regarding Sheila's death, were dropped. So when Teresa learned of the deal that Robert had made with the district attorney's office, she decided she didn't want to take her chances on a death sentence and offered to plead guilty in exchange for her life. The DA agreed, and Teresa changed her plea to guilty. During sentencing, the judge characterized Teresa's crimes as callousness beyond belief.
Well, yeah, I would agree.
Absolutely. And he sentenced her to 2 consecutive life sentences. In 2027, she'll be eligible for parole. She'll be 80 years old.
So the thing that gets me is this case could have been solved a lot sooner if people would have spoken up about the strange behavior of Teresa as a mother. Also, when Terry tried to tell people, including the Utah police, they didn't even check out the facts, which could have been done quite easily. Robert, who was still serving out his murder charge, was sentenced to 3 years in state prison. The court ordered the sentence run concurrently with his 1991 murder sentence. William was placed on probation for his role in the murders, and he was ordered to undergo therapy. In April 2003, the Plain Dealer, a Cleveland, Ohio newspaper, ran an article, and it was titled, "Searching for Answers on Mothers Who Kill." According to this story, an American mother kills her child at the rate of once every 3 days. These cases are patterned and predictable, says Michelle Oberman, who's a legal scholar and expert on women who kill their offspring. They're not shocking, she says. They are mundane. We just don't want to know what we know. I find that very poignant.
Yes.
Because I think there's a lot of denial here.
There's no question.
Yeah.
Now, Terry Knorr, the youngest child, died of a heart attack at age 41 in the year 2011.
That woman had had a rough life.
Certainly had. It's just incredible. In 2016, Robert Knorr Jr. was sentenced to 8 years in federal prison after pleading guilty to charges of distribution and possession of child pornography. His prior convictions for murder and accessory to murder after the fact were cited in his sentencing, of course.
So it's not only these two daughters that she murdered whose lives were destroyed, it's really all the kids.
There was an article, you had told me that there was an article you read in the Sacramento Bee, which said that all of her children were deceased, and the article was written just a year ago.
Yeah, I couldn't find each child and what they died of. All I could find was Terry. But I did read that they were all dead and that she was still in prison alive. So that's the most recent information I could find on where everything's at right now.
Yeah, you can look at this family, this history, and figure, no wonder those kids got so messed up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I guess you could almost even say that Teresa's problems stemmed from her upbringing.
Although, a point, but her upbringing wasn't anything horrendous like her own children.
Not like her kids.
No. So there are two books on this case. One is called Mother's Day by Dennis McDougall, and the other is called Whatever Mother Says by Wensley Clarkson. There are also numerous newspaper articles from the Sacramento Bee and the Sacramento Union. There have been TV shows that have covered it, including the A&E series Cold Case Files. And that one has an interview with Terry Knorr. And the case was also profiled on the series Most Evil, Wicked Attraction, and of course, our favorite, Deadly Women, on ID.
Well, there's a lot of stuff written about her.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's quite exceptional. And no matter how much I read that mothers do kill their children on a regular basis, I still can't get over it. I still find it shocking.
Absolutely.
So before we get to feedback, I have a bit of Tiegrabber housekeeping to go over. We've had a lot of new members sign up lately, which is great, and it really makes us want to provide high-quality episodes for our members-only feed. Right now we're working on the sad, tragic case of Samantha Zaldivar. Samantha disappeared in a situation that happens all too often in the United States, and we're really delving into the family dynamics and the investigation. And I think you'll find it fascinating, even though it will be difficult to hear about, as are all cases involving children. They're all very disturbing, of course. But I personally see some value in these discussions, because I feel like if we pay attention to these situations where things go so horribly wrong, that's really the only way we can work to prevent them from happening to another child. I mean, keeping your head in the sand never helps.
No, knowledge is power.
That's right.
Are told.
Even though some knowledge is painful to have.
Yes.
So this episode I'm talking about, that'll be out in the next several days. Plus, as you probably know, we have a backlog of over 20 members-only episodes, and we put out new ones each month. So you can sign up to get access to these episodes by going to our website, tiegrabber.com, and signing up for a small PayPal payment each month. We really appreciate our members more than anything, and we are going to happily send you a package of gifts to thank you for your support. My goal is for every one of our listeners to have a TCB snifter or bottle opener, So we'll see if we can ever get there. You can also give support by becoming a patron at patreon.com/truecrimebrewery. And there we have 3 tiers of support with 3 different gifts that you can get. So enough of this shameless plugging. Why don't we do feedback, Dick? I think we have a couple of voicemails.
We have a couple of voicemails to start us off with. First up is Izzy from Newcastle.
Hi, Dick and Jill. My name's Izzy, and I'm calling you from Newcastle in northeast England. We're famous for Newcastle Brown Ale, so perhaps Dick has heard of us. But I just wanted to say that you guys are you're my favourite podcast. I look forward to seeing you in my feed every week, and you're the first one that I've subscribed to. I've just subscribed today and seen that I've got loads and loads of bonus episodes to listen to, and I'm so excited that I've got loads to get through. I just wanted to say that I found it really interesting that you covered the Rebecca Watts case. That actually took place in my hometown of Bristol. And when we were there, it was a weird time because obviously that case was so horrific. You know, she was murdered by, you know, essentially her brother. And it is just the kind of ending that no one expects. And it was very interesting to hear it from an American perspective, because I think that a lot of cases in the UK aren't really very well known over there. And I really appreciated that you covered that. I wanted to recommend another British case, this one from where I live now, so in Newcastle. In 2016, a man called Jimmy Prout was found dead. He'd been abused and tortured by a group of people that he had thought were his friends. He was a vulnerable adult. He had learning difficulties, but was by all accounts a really lovely, kind-hearted man. And these group of people that he was living with, they over several months they systematically kind of tortured him and put him through unimaginable pain. The details are really quite quite horrific. But it's a really interesting case, and it's not had a lot of attention really outside of our region. And I think it would be a really interesting case to cover if you can kind of find out enough information about it. I don't know how much is actually out there. But yeah, I just thought maybe that would be interesting to you. Thanks again for the podcast. I love it. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, I have drunk plenty of Newcastle Brown Ale in my time.
Yes,
you have. It's a nice beer.
Yes.
Now, this case that Izzy refers to, Jimmy Prout is was a 45-year-old male, as Izzy said, a special needs, vulnerable person. So he had some learning issues and was the father of 2 kids. That he became friends with the wrong people, and they systematically tortured him over time, finally killed him. So Ann Corbett, Myra Wood, Kay Rayworth, and Zahid Zaman were accused of murdering him. And in fact, Corbett and Zaman were found guilty of murder. Rayworth and Wood were found not guilty of murder, but were found guilty of causing or allowing the death of a vulnerable adult. And apparently from what I was reading, and I haven't gotten that deeply into it, they were very sadistic, horrible things. Knocking his teeth out, cutting his testicles off, making him eat them. It's just horrible stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm going to look a little more deeply into it, but I'm not sure I can stomach doing a story about that.
Okay.
But we'll see.
All right. Thanks for calling in, Izzy. Definitely appreciate that.
Yes. And then we have a voice message from Chelsea S. Let's hear what Chelsea S. has to say.
Hey, Dick and Jill. This is Chelsea calling. I am from northern Minnesota up by the Canadian border, and I am a huge fan. I found you guys about a month and a half ago, and I've been hooked ever since. So I've gotten to listen to all your podcasts, plus I became a member, a Tie Grabber member, I should say, and I've listened to all those as well. And I just received my Tie Grabber package in the mail yesterday, and I was so pumped when I saw it in the mailbox. I will be posting some fun pictures on social media, because that's how excited I am and proud I am of it. So thank you for the gift, and thank you for the entertainment. You guys are so good together. The dynamic between you two is so perfect. You guys are funny, and I find myself laughing out loud. And my husband thinks I'm kind of crazy, but I think he thought that before this podcast. And I'm not a beer drinker, but you've made me want to be. And so now I've been on a mission to find something that I can actually enjoy. And I'm thinking maybe a stout. I might be a stout girl, Dick. We'll see. Uh-uh. I'm going to get some and try it because they sound good and you make them sound delicious. I was just curious if maybe you guys would be interested in talking about Waco, Texas with David Koresh. I know it is a sensitive topic just because there are two very different sides to the story. I'm not sure if there's any new information on it, but if there is, it would be wonderful to hear it from you guys. My aunt passed away in the compound. She was only 49 years old. And just to hear you guys talk about it would be really interesting for me. It holds a special place in my family. And it would be nice to understand maybe a little more about the whole situation, because I'm still not sure of all the details myself. But anyway, I understand if you guys can't do it, just because I know that it's well played, if you will say. But maybe if there's anything new, you guys can put a different twist on it. That would be awesome. Either way, you got a fan for life. Can't get rid of me, so embrace it. Anyway, I wish you guys all the best, and I'm sure I will leave another voicemail.
All right, she got cut off a little bit there, but thank you, Chelsea.
A little bit of a scratchy recording.
Not terrible.
We got her.
Yep.
So the Waco, Texas case, David Koresh and his cult.
Yeah, can I just say I'm really sorry about your aunt, just before we go on?
You can.
Okay, I'm sorry about that, Chelsea. That's terrible.
But we've had a lot of people requesting this.
We have. We've had several requests.
And
that's
true. It is fascinating to us at the same time. So put that down. I don't know exactly when, but within the next few months, we'll do a Waco episode or two.
Okay. I think it's a big job. I think it'll be a big one.
It is a big one.
Yeah.
A lot of material to read over.
Yeah.
Or listen to.
But definitely, I would like to do it. Sure.
I would too.
Okay.
And then the lighter note, if you're not a beer drinker, and you do decide to try a stout, my advice would be to try a lower alcohol one first. Or if you're dead set on buying something above 10%, just make sure you share it with somebody.
Yeah, there's some popular ones that are distributed throughout the U.S. that any names that would be in the top of your list you would recommend? Because you've had a couple stout girls call in lately.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you get it in Minnesota, but Prairie's Bomb, B-O-M-B. Is probably my favorite stout. That's kind of big at 13%, but it's just an excellent stout. And I haven't given much thought to other ones, but yeah, they're all over the place.
Yeah, well, and they're all over on our webpage in Dick's Beer Cellar. There are a lot of stouts.
Look that up.
So I'd peruse that too.
Okay.
Okay, so now we have a couple of emails to do.
Yeah, why don't you read Penelope's?
Okay, this is a long one, but we edited it a little. So this is from Penelope. This is titled Random Thoughts About Your Excellent Podcast. So how could we resist that?
We couldn't.
Hello, Jill and Dick. As a travel RN, I spend countless hours on the road. When I asked my daughter about audiobooks, she introduced me to podcasts. Good grief, any topic you want to know about. And I discovered a true crime bonanza. I've been a fan since my dad told me mafia stories when I was a kid. No, he didn't belong. But he knew mafiosi as a young musician in Pittsburgh.
I can imagine sitting on your dad's lap and he's telling you mafia stories. And she grew up
true.
Okay, I guess.
She did okay. I listened to podcasts from The Ridiculous to The Robotic and eventually found the cream of the crop, you. Some things that make your show the best are the diligent research you put in, the respectful dialogue between the two of you, even when you disagree. It is obvious you have an easy and loving partnership. And the seriousness with which you treat the crimes and the respect that you give the victims. I am drawn to Jill's unfailing compassion. I appreciate Dick's dry wit, and I enjoy his take on things as a physician. Some standout moments for me have been your compassion for the terribly mentally ill Andrea Yates and the traumatized Rhonda Stapley. Your suggestions at the end of the Shaken Babies stories and how this could be avoided. The Michael Peterson case, covered with different theories. And finally, the interview with the diving expert in the honeymoon drowning case. It was mesmerizing. My traveling time passes so much more quickly listening to your well-presented episodes, and I thank you so much. So that was a lot more praise than I expected to read, but yeah, I appreciate it.
Tried to sneak that one in on you.
Yeah. Since you are gracious enough to take suggestions, I have two I would like to hear you cover sometime. First is the murder of the child Charisse Iverson by the teen Jerry Strohmeyer in a Las Vegas casino. It is horrifying, but brings up a number of topics. Jeremy Strohmeyer had nice parents, but was adopted, and his bio mom had severe schizophrenia, which they were not told about. Nature versus nurture, ? Why was the little girl running around alone in the casino at 4 a.m.? Does her gambling father share blame? And how about David Cash, the bad Samaritan who saw his friend in the act of molesting and killing Charisse and did nothing to stop him? A law was changed because of this case. The second case is the Taconic Parkway crash. Ever since I saw the documentary, Something's Wrong with Aunt Diane, I have been fascinated with how and why this perfect wife and mother did something so horrendous. I would like to hear from Dick's medical standpoint what he thinks. Even after several years, online discussions are very polarized about this case. Well, I will close by saying I have never liked beer, but some of Dick's descriptions make me want to go and try some craft beers. My husband says it will still taste like beer. Is that so? Is it worth a try? You want to answer that, or you want to wait till after I finish reading?
I'll let you finish.
Okay. What would you suggest for someone who thinks Budweiser tastes like rotten eggs? Thank you again for your stories, your integrity, and your heart. You're the gourmet of the true crime smorgasbord. Take care and enjoy getting settled in your new home. I wish you all good things. Cheers, Penelope from Kentucky.
Well, thank you, Penelope. But we get embarrassed at hearing it.
Yeah, well.
But anyway.
But do you want to answer the beer question before we talk about the cases?
Sure, that's the easy part.
Okay.
I think the first thing off the top of my head is if you think Budweiser tastes like rotten eggs, you're probably not going to be a beer drinker.
Because to you, Budweiser's like water.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, if you do want to try some beer, my suggestion would be to try something nice and light, like an Allagash White.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty widely distributed. I think you might like that. Don't bother drinking the macros like Bud and Miller and Coors and stuff like that.
How about a light fruity sour?
Yeah.
It's kind of like a cider.
I think if you do a sour, I'd be careful about getting one that's not too tart, which you can't always tell from the label or anything. Because some of those sours will just pucker you right up.
Well, some of them, but I mean like a light fruity one. A lot of people who like cider have enjoyed a light sour.
Yeah.
Or just drink cider. Cider's great. You don't have to drink beer.
No.
Cover your ears, Dick, but it's not necessary to have a full life.
It's not a requirement.
No. All right. On to the cases.
Both of these are fascinating cases. So why don't you tell me about Jeremy Strohmeyer?
Okay. Well, he was a Long Beach, California man who murdered a 7-year-old Los Angeles elementary school student, Charisse Iverson, at the Prima Donna Resort and Casino in Prim, Nevada, in 1997. Now, this case drew national attention by focusing on the safety of children in casinos and on the revelation that Strohmeyer's friend, David Cash Jr., said he saw the crime in progress but didn't stop it. To me, that makes him just as guilty.
Absolutely.
Now, in the early morning hours of May 25th, 1997, two males, Jeremy and David, Jeremy was 18, David was 17, were at this resort, and the two men had arrived at the gambling establishment with Cash's father. Now, around 4 a.m., Strohmeyer began repeatedly making playful, in quotes, contact with 7-year-old Charisse Iverson, who was roaming the casino alone. So this young girl's father was gambling and drinking, and he left Charisse in the care of her 14-year-old brother Harold in the casino's arcade. This resulted in Charisse running around unmonitored. She had been returned to her father several times throughout the day, having been found alone by security, and eventually Strohmeyer followed her into a woman's restroom. While in the restroom, the two began throwing wet paper wads at each other. Charisse then reportedly tossed a yellow plastic wet floor sign at Strohmeyer. And around this time, his friend David Cash entered the restroom, and he witnessed Strohmeyer forcibly taking little Charisse into a stall. When Cash looked in from the adjacent stall, he saw Strohmeyer holding his left hand over the little girl's mouth and fondling her. After this, Cash left the restroom and was followed 20 minutes later by Strohmeyer, who immediately confessed to him that he had molested and killed this girl. 3 days later, Strohmeyer was taken into custody at his home. Two classmates in Long Beach had identified him after security tape footage captured by cameras at the casino was released by Nevada police and played on television news. Strohmeyer was charged with first-degree murder, first-degree kidnapping, and sexual assault of a minor. When questioned by police, Strohmeyer stated that he molested her and strangled her to stifle her screams. Before leaving, Strohmeyer noticed Iverson was still alive and twisted her head in an attempt to break her neck. And after hearing a loud popping sound, he rested her body in a sitting position on the toilet. That's upsetting. But Strohmeyer claimed he was high on alcohol and drugs at the time and didn't remember it. It was even suggested that perhaps the witness, David Cash, had in fact been the one to murder her, because Strohmeyer had no recollection. But I guess the big issue here, because we know there are sickos like that out there, to me is why are people letting their children run around unattended at a casino?
Yeah, what's with that?
I'd really like to see if the father was charged with anything. I suppose he suffered enough that he lost his daughter, but that's just very blatant neglect.
Well, plus he had been told more than one occasion during that time in the casino.
Yeah.
That he couldn't leave his kids unattended. And it wasn't just the 7-year-old. She had a 14-year-old brother who was supposedly keeping an eye on her. Which
yeah. Now that boy's going to feel guilty the rest of his life.
Yeah.
It's awful. Yeah. I remember seeing a special on 2020 or something about people who, I guess, gambling, you know, can be an addiction. And they bring their children to casinos and just kind of forget about them because they get into their gambling.
Right. Free-range casino children.
It's terrible.
But there's a lot of interesting things.
There are a lot of things.
About yeah. this, besides the parental neglect.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got the friend who witnessed the crime but didn't say anything about it.
Right.
And you've got the family history. Mental health issues. So,
right.
Mm-hmm. And that'd be a good one to do.
Yeah, I think that would be a fascinating one to cover. Now, the next one, the Taconic Parkway crash. I've seen the movie, and this is a fascinating story.
This is absolutely fascinating.
So why don't you give us a quick rundown of what it's about, although most people probably know.
I'm glad that Penelope suggested it, because I had thought about doing it, and then it left my mind for a while, and she brought it back, and I said, oh, yeah. Diane Schuler, her husband, their two kids, and her brother's three kids were in a campground for the weekend. And they get up in the next morning to head home. So Dad is going to drive the boat home, tow the boat home. Diane, the mom, is going to take the five kids in the minivan. So off they go. It's fairly early morning, 7:30, 8 o'clock. What happened during that time isn't really well known. But apparently, at some point, Diane found herself going the wrong way on the Taconic Parkway. She drove the wrong way on an off-ramp and got facing traffic. She drove a couple miles before she was hit head-on by another car, or she hit someone else head-on. But anyway, horrific crash that killed her two kids, two of the three other kids. One survived the crash, but I think died later on. And the three occupants of the other car were all killed.
Mm.
So horrible stuff. Now, you're trying to find out what happened, and this is the interesting part. She's this perfect image of a doting mother and doting aunt, a hardworking executive who brought in a six-figure salary, and practically a teetotaler. So why was her blood alcohol at autopsy 0.19, which is 2.5 times the legal limit? And she also had THC in her system. So what's going on with that? Her persona doesn't agree with what the autopsy findings found.
No. Now, you haven't seen the documentary, have you?
Yes, I have.
Oh, you have? Okay. So you remember there's footage of her stopping at like a 7-Eleven type store, a gas station.
Oh, yeah.
And it looks like she put something in her bottle.
Right.
I mean, to me, it seems like she had to be drinking on purpose. You don't accidentally have that in your system.
No. They found the bottle in the car
mm-hmm.
at the crash site, and she had alcohol still in her stomach. And they estimated she had taken 10 to 11 shots
wow.
of the vodka.
This is in the morning, right?
This was in the morning. And that's the other thing, is that this was not a long drive from the campground to their home. And it took hours and hours and hours. And people were starting to get worried about, where the hell is she?
And she didn't just accidentally go the wrong way. She was flooring the car. A lot of people thought she purposely did this.
She was driving aggressively, tailgating, honking the horn. Fascinating story.
It is, yeah. I think we could talk for hours about that.
We're definitely going to do that.
Okay.
So Penelope, thank you. Great letter.
Two great
case suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
And enjoy the beer.
If you do it. Let us know what you think.
Okay, the final letter from Lance M. about Bed of Lies, the murder of Lori Hacking. You take this one because you remember this better than I do.
Okay. So Lance writes, I was friends with both of them. They were apartment managers, and I worked on their complex. Lori was very positive. I was very upset, as was the community. Both families at the funeral talked about the world being good and talked about forgiveness. I was inspired by their message of not holding on to hatred. Mark had lied to me, and I was very blindsided by who I thought he was. I have a lot of respect for the family, and even so, he was a messed up individual.
That he was. Now, this was the husband who lied about attending med school and stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, he said he was going to med school, and they think that she found out, and there was some kind of argument, and then kind of the classic case, I hate to say it, but he said she was missing.
Yep.
And everyone was looking for her.
Right.
And I think they found a bloody mattress in a dumpster. I don't know. There's a whole episode we did, like you said, called Bed of Lies. So.
Yes. But now we got someone who knew them.
Yeah. Well, I'm always happy to hear from someone who knew the victims or the perpetrators, someone who thinks we did a fair job. You know, because they actually know what happened.
That's right.
So it'd be easy for them to get fed up with us if we make a lot of mistakes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So thank you, Lance.
Yeah, thanks, Lance. Thanks, everybody who wrote in and called.
Yeah, keep those letters and mail coming.
Great feedback.
All right.
All right, anything to add before we sign off for the day?
I think it's time to hit the pool.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you all for listening. And thank you to Tristan Capel for his music.
Good music. New intro.
New intro, new outro.
New outro. All right. Okay. See you at the quiet end, folks.
We'll see you next time at the quiet end. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ka-choo. Boop, 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 boop.